why are we still talking to children about their bodies this way? Like, if the most important thing that you're focusing on is that your kid is not the size you want them to be, you just, there's some things you can't take back when you're talking to kids. And once you introduce this concept that they need to be watching their body size, it's really hard to undo. It's a big slippery slope.
Hi, I'm Sylvia Beckerman. Join me today as I talk to an extraordinary woman who is changing the world by making a difference in her life and the lives of those around her.
Hi, welcome to Sylvia and Me. I'm Molly Wadzik-Krause, and I'm a poet and essayist.
Molly, thank you so much for being here with me today, because I find you so interesting. You have written so many essays. Your focus is on, you cover culture, parenting, feminism, mental health, reproductive rights. So I want to touch on a number of those things as we go through. And what I'll do is mention a couple of the titles of the essays, and we'll just have a conversation about that. Sure. So I'd like to start off with parenting, considering you're the parent of three children between 2 and 11. I'm the parent of two children, but they're 36 and 39, but I do have a grandson. I make sure I tell everyone about my grandson. He's almost 2. Parenting, as much as people might say it's evolved or it's changed or whatever, parenting is parenting. We might learn a little stuff from year to year, from generation to generation. We may always say we never want to be like our parents, or we want to be just like our parents. So I'd like to, one of the first ones I want to talk about is an essay you wrote about, my 10-year-old was diagnosed with ADHD. I learned that I had it in my early 30s, and I'm giving her the support I never got. Can you tell us how you realized you learned you had it when you were in your 30s? Your children are quite young. How are you being supported? How are you handling this?
Yeah, that's a really good question, because a lot of the days I don't feel like I'm handling it. With the way ADHD, especially in my own experiences and my research and talking to doctors, how it shows up and presents itself in little girls and women is a whole lot different than the stereotypical way that it shows up in little boys, which is what people usually think of when they think of ADHD. They think of rambunctious, can't concentrate, can't focus. But there's this whole other side of it that can manifest as anxiety. And anxiety can, oh my gosh, it can appear so many different ways. For me, as a kid, it's talking nonstop, and still as an adult, it is feeling incredibly overwhelmed, having sensory difficulties with feeling like there's too much sensory input from different directions. So you can imagine as a parent, that's compounded. You think of having several young children under the age of 10, everyone needs something at the same time, and you're standing in the kitchen and you feel like your mind's going to explode. You're so overwhelmed. So my ADHD diagnosis was kind of a gradual process of trying to address the underlying reasons why I had an alcohol abuse problem. There was an underlying reason why I struggle with sleep, while I struggled with really having difficulty keeping myself organized and staying on task. And it was pretty easy to recognize when my daughter was young that she was very much like me. And it just clicked one day in my therapist's office. She asked me, has anyone ever asked you to take an ADHD screener? Because we were talking about all these things, right? Feeling really overwhelmed. And this was pre-pandemic. So there was no, oh gosh, I just feel like I can't handle anything because it feels like the world is imploding and all this stuff. And it just clicked into place. And it was pretty soon after that that I recognized, oh wow, my kid is struggling with all the things that I struggle with as a kid. And if I can find a way to learn the tools to help myself, I can give her a way better head start than I had as a kid.
Well, you know, years ago, I'd say about 30 years ago, ADHD was the buzzword. Everyone had it. They, you know, between ADHD and the other things that were similar to it, Ritalin was the go-to thing. You could see it on TV. And all of a sudden, children were, oh, that's me. I need that medication. I need this. I need that. We have come on this particular topic, we have come a lot further than it's the thing to have. It's a real condition. It's a real, you're talking anxiety and being able to actually say this, wow, I recognize it. So how did you, especially you mentioned the pandemic and this was pre-pandemic, how did you get through the pandemic with being able to support your daughter?
Yeah, I mean, that's it's a great question for all parents, right? I think we were all, I mean, everyone was in survival mode, but I think one of the biggest pieces of my story is becoming sober. I always say, had I not become sober before the pandemic, it would have been disastrous. Like, I don't even want to think of what kind of parent I would have been, what the state of my mental health would have been, and how I could have even shown up for my kids to help them through that transition if I hadn't been sober. And being sober is a big piece of my ADHD management. One of the reasons why I had the alcohol abuse issue is because I was self-medicating from things related to my ADHD, which was a big discovery for me. So finding ways to give her and I, both of us, the sensory input we needed to calm down our nervous systems was a big piece of that. So I don't try to be careful of what I share about my children. I try to run things by them, but she's very open about talking about this. She very much wants to destigmatize it for kids as well. And she talks about having ADHD. You know, it's my brain works differently. It's my neurodivergence. It's like a part of her identity, which I think is so beautiful, just embracing who she is. And we talked about it together about different ways that we move through the world. And so I think that finding those strategies that work better for her for learning at home when we were homeschooling and remote schooling was important. She wasn't a kid that could sit at the table and do the worksheets. You know, she was miserable. So we would get outside and we were in nature. This was back when we had about 7 or 8 acres. We would just be in the woods for a lot of the day, and then we would come in and she would sprawl on top of the kitchen table and like watch the lesson and do a little, but it's a lot of moving the body and like making sure that you're getting that all your physical and emotional needs met as well.
Well, you mentioned something that I give your daughter a lot of credit. You can call her a model for young girls in wanting to get rid of the stigma, because it's a real thing. And that is so important in mental health. And you talk about mental health quite a bit because our young children are going through a crisis.
Yeah.
And yes, we are just starting to talk about it. We have some, high up celebrities actually coming out and talking about their mental health issues, whatever it was. And we need to talk about it. If we keep it inside, it's going to explode, as we see what's happening with so many young people. So I give her a lot of gold stars because good for her. I mean, that's fantastic. She is showing that she is a model to be looked after. And I don't mean a model, little model. I'm talking about a role model. So yeah. Evidently you have raised a very, very nice young lady.
Well, I can't take a whole lot of credit. You know, I think that kids come out who they are, and you have to find the ways to nurture who they are. And some kids there's no containing them, you know? And I think our culture has really shifted too, in the way, like you're saying, with celebrities talking more openly, even in, our public schools. I remember getting my like behavior card moved to red when I was a kid. I talk about that in that essay. And in there's still some of that obviously in a lot of schools, but my kids will come home talking about, you know, oh, we had a mindfulness hour today, you know? And could you imagine what kind of healthier adults we would have now in our generations had we been taught mindfulness and emotional regulation at that age? I think it's such an incredible change.
Social emotional learning.
Yeah.
Which is a big thing. We've seen the changes in these young people who are actually being able to be made aware of this and learning it in school, which hopefully then, you know, translates to their home environment. You mentioned something else. You mentioned the word sleep. And another one of your essays was, how can we help our teens get more sleep? Because sleep is so important. And all the studies that are coming out now about the crisis and epidemic of mental health in youth, one of the things that they talk about is how important sleep is.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Well, that article, I have to give credit. I wish I had the book in front of me right now. It's downstairs in my bookshelf, but it was an interview with authors. Do you have the name in front of you from the article? I just want to be able to give them credit.
I don't have the people.
Yeah, Generation Sleepless is the name of the book. And it was so eye-opening. There's a lot of things that when experts tell them to you or you read an article, you're like, oh, that makes sense, right? And then reading this book and learning about how teen sleep needs, the way that their brains, the stage of development that they're in, are, that kind of dips back to being closer to toddler needs, like the window shift, and that our public schools are designed to accommodate the 9-to-5 work shift, right? So that there's just a misalignment of the needs of teens and the needs of our workplace culture. You know, my kids, my older two kids at least, complain a lot. Well, I guess now and then they complain about our really strict bedtime. And this wasn't anything that we implemented together based on research. It was just, oh my gosh, wow, if our kids don't get to bed at this specific time, they're kind of, you know, they can't handle life. They're kind of like monsters, which I am too when I don't get enough sleep. But it's one of the things that I'm not often flexible on unless it's a very, very special event, because I know how much more difficult it is to function when you're not getting adequate sleep. And again, you know, I'm not a neuroscientist. I try to read a lot. I do a lot of research for my writing and I speak to a lot of experts, but my mental health suffers when I don't get enough sleep. So it makes sense for children with the rapid development of their brain growth. The sleep is the basis of everything. And it's a privileged position to say, because I don't have to go into an office for 9-to-5. I'm also won't be targeted for delinquency based on like my race and my social standing and all those kind of factors that affect that. But if my kid had a hard night, I don't sweat them being late to school. I'm not rushing you out the door. We try to be respectful to the school system and the teachers, but there has to be some flexibility there to make sure that our kids' brains are being protected, because they can't go and be a good citizen and a good student and show up in the world how they need to if they're sleep deprived.
Exactly. And, you know, as I get older and go into high school, for some reason, we've actually made the hours of school earlier and earlier.
Yes.
And it's so absurd, because we know that their brains do not function that early in the morning. And we're doing such a disservice to our teens, to our youth.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. Yeah. And there are some states that are passing legislation. I can't think off the top of my head, but there are definitely some states within the movement that book talks about that have teamed up with pediatricians advocating for later school starts. But I'm sure it's a complicated thing to figure out.
There's one other topic in regards to parenting that I'd like to hit on, because I actually talked to someone who put out a book regarding eating disorders and the crisis that it is. And you also have written a number of essays on ED. One, as a parent in ED recovery, the ways we're talking about Ozempic, weight loss, and kids' bodies terrify me, as they should terrify everyone. Can you just expand a little on that? And then we'll hop on to another area.
Sure.
But I think it's very important.
Yeah. And I always emphasize too, when I speak about eating disorders, that for, at least for me personally, it's not a thing of the past, right? I always describe my eating disorder as kind of like this little monster that I can lock away in the back of my brain. And as long as I have these things lined up, right? Like my mental health, I'm taking care of my body, I'm moving my body, I'm getting enough sleep. All these factors go into how loud the monster is and how quiet it is. And knowing that I was going to become a parent when I did, it was very important to me to find resources and ways to talk about, to talk to kids and talk about body image that was neutral. So we have a family rule that is, you know, we don't comment on others' bodies, whether it's negative or positive. We don't comment on others' bodies. We don't comment on others' food. Everyone eats different foods. And that's just kind of the way that I approach that. My parents were incredible, but I don't really think they had any idea what was going on until I got very sick as a teenager. And they didn't have the language. You know, there was just, it wasn't really talked about back then in the 90s. So the article came about, I don't know if you remember, there was a super viral, incredibly interesting article on The Cut, which is part of New York Magazine, that was about people being prescribed Ozempic off-label to lose weight. This went viral and I thought, oh God, this is horrifying. You know, this is horrifying. And around the same time, I believe it was the AAP, the American Academy of Pediatrics, released new guidelines for obesity in children. I listen to a lot, I read and listen to a lot of fat activists and advocates like Lindy West and Aubrey Gordon and people that speak on moving away from obesity as a disease and just accepting people for who they are. And so those two things coalesced. And I had an amazing editor at She Knows that agreed to let me kind of combine these two concepts. Like, here's this big cultural moment we're talking about with Ozempic. And then at the same time, the AAP comes out with these guidelines that just seem so radically just off, I guess. I don't know a better word to describe it. But
oh, off is good.
Why are we still talking to children about their bodies this way? Like, if the most important thing that you're focusing on is that your kid is not the size you want them to be, there's some things you can't take back when you're talking to kids. And once you introduce this concept that they need to be watching their body size, it's really hard to undo. It's a big slippery slope.
And it is a slippery slope, and it is a disorder. And there, you know, with social media, it's gotten 100 times worse, especially during the pandemic, because all they had was a screen. They had the internet. They didn't have any other way of meeting and connecting with people. So they were able to connect with all these other people that they would never meet. And body image is so ingrained in the society that it's scary, beyond scary.
It's really scary, especially when you talk about being online all the time in regard to the pandemic or just in general. The way, you know, we were used to airbrush images in magazines when we were younger. But with AI filters, with the TikTok filters, with how convincing all of these filters and tools are online, you're not consuming any real images. So having a teenage brain or a child brain and not the awareness and critical thinking skills to be discerning about what we're seeing, even as adults, my self-esteem gets affected. If I'm on TikTok or Instagram too much, I notice my self-esteem takes a dive because I'm consuming edited images, right?
Yes. Yes.
The more that teens spend online looking at that without remembering this is not real, of course it's going to affect them.
Well, I'm glad we brought it up, and I'm glad you're talking about it, because it's a crisis. It's a mental health crisis. I want to move on to another one of your topics, reproductive rights and abortion. And one of the things that really got me was one of your first ones on your website: why do more people get tubal ligations than vasectomies? Go to it. Let's hear it.
This was a really fun one to research and write. And I will tell you, the doctor I spoke with, Dr. Goldstein at Cornell, who is actually the doctor that brought over the no-scalpel vasectomy technique from China way back when, he was so much fun to talk with. He was so excited to talk about the... I got really angry writing this, and I had a lot of fun. So the research shows that men get vasectomies on average anywhere from half the amount or a third of the amount that women end up getting tubal ligations or tubal ablations, whichever procedure they do. And it makes no sense to me at all. And I thought, there has to be something behind this. What is behind this? Part of it is education, as Dr. Goldstein spoke about. It's just when you go to your doctor, like women and people with uteruses are often in front of their medical providers more often, right? As we are the ones that are giving birth, they check in with us more. There needs to be more education in the medical field and with not even just specialized doctors, but just men going for checkups. Check in, like, how's your family planning? You know, we need to start the conversation with our sons as they had it. Like, you are just as responsible. We don't need to just be talking to our daughters. Again, this needs to be a cultural shift to change these rates. We are the ones that have periods. We're the ones that have to deal with everything. And to go through an invasive major surgery should be a choice that a woman makes, right? Like, we should fully be able to make that decision and not do it just because our partner has been misinformed about vasectomy or just hasn't heard of it. That's a big part of it. So I think the biggest key takeaway that I learned from that is the cultural shift needs to start when boys are entering puberty as they get older and they're starting to have sex lives. You are just as responsible. When you get older and you have a partner, you need to check in with your doctor. Doctors need training on asking their male patients, so what are you doing about birth control? Do you want to have any more children? How is your partner feeling if you have a partner? And that's what it needs to do. It basically comes down to misogyny. We just don't think that men should take responsibility for it. So there's no incentive to ask them and even put it on their mind. So then you end up in a situation where maybe you've had 2, 3, 4 kids and your partner's like, oh, I don't want someone touching my junk. What do you mean? Ow, I don't want to do that. Take away my manhood. It's just incredible to me that so many misconceptions from adult males in their 30s and 40s still feel squeamish about it.
Oh, yes, they do. And it's something that we need to shift, especially with everything that's going on with abortion bans and reproductive rights. It's just up there. It always made me mad that a woman was responsible for birth control, the birth control pill, an IUD, you know, and all these guys who, I don't want to use a condom. I don't like it. You know, I don't want it. And so if anything happens, it's always the woman's fault. And usually it is, as you said, the woman will get a tubal ligation because what guy's going to get, you know, a vasectomy, please? But yes, children need, boys, young boys need to be asked that, because as they're growing and starting to have sex, that talk has to be in there. And then when they get married and do have children, that talk has to be in there. And I am so glad that you brought this up in your, because it's not something that is talked about. There have been Twitter, you know, things going back and forth from women who are so angry, you know, why is it a woman's responsibility always to make sure that a pregnancy doesn't happen?
The amount of women I found on Reddit threads and baby center forums complaining about their husband's refusal to consider it. I mean, women are divorcing their husbands and leaving their partners because it's a basic respect. Like, you're not going to put my life at risk by having unprotected sex with me or safer sex with me as far as not getting pregnant again. And I think that's the bottom line, because men will come back with this argument I read time and time again of, well, if it's my body, it's my choice, and it's my body, it's my choice not to get a vasectomy. Okay, then I'm not having sex with you. Because if there's a chance for me to get pregnant, that risks my health and my life every time I get pregnant. So I think that conversation, like you said, it really has to happen earlier on so you don't end up with men in their 30s and 40s having no idea.
Right. And they have no idea. That's the thing. One other one that I want to hit on that particular segment. You wrote, Scary Mommy, Abortion is not the opposite of motherhood.
Yeah, that's one of my favorites. Hannah Matthews, it's about her book, and she is an abortion doula, which, funnily enough, even though I've been involved in abortion rights movement for a decade and a half now, I didn't know there were abortion doulas. And the concept of it was just so beautiful to me. Reframing abortion as part of the natural order of life and connecting it to whatever spiritual connection you have, whatever religion you are, or however you connect with higher power or nature or owning your own body. Being able to say, I reject society's stigma about my choice of how I plan my life, about my choice, but how I honor how I move through the world, the family I want to create, and the decisions that I make for myself. And one of the things that Hannah does so beautifully in the book is just flat out, I can't remember the exact quote, but it's essentially, I reject the basic arguments if we're going to argue about whether or not abortion is a human right, because that's a religious belief. That's a different religious belief that we're not even going to go there. So at face value, we are accepting how people show up in the world, and we are incorporating it as a decision that any person would make about how they want to live their life. And it resonated with me because I wouldn't have the family that I did without abortion. You know, being able to decide in my mental health state and in our financial state, and then what I wanted for myself, what I want to do with my body, what I need to give for my already existing children. Abortion is just part of that story. For some women, it's a very difficult decision, and honoring that, I guess, however you react to it, honoring that entire journey and mourning if you need to. There are, I guess, services and traditions and rituals that are important to a lot of different people. It's just a radical acceptance of the decisions we make about our bodies and our families. And it can be a gift. It can be a gift to the children that you already have.
Definitely. And studies and you know, have shown that. And women do not make the decision like buying a pair of shoes. I mean, you know, it's not something that we don't angst over and think about, and really the decision is not a snap decision. So for so many women, there's so many who already have families, and then there are ones who aren't ready to start a family. And you know, it is a huge chunk of life that for some people are being forced to totally change the makeup of their life and almost destroy it. No matter what anyone, you know, thinks, it's a personal choice.
And I can't think of anything more violent than forcing someone to endure 9 months of pregnancy and forcing them to give birth when you do not want it. It's, in my opinion, a violent act. And I think when we say abortion is not the opposite of motherhood, these two choices of how we want to show up in the world and the identities that we want to take on can come together to create our futures and our future families. And I just thought it was such a radical, beautiful way of looking at something that really wasn't even political or radicalized until, you know, it became good fodder for the Republicans. It's abortion's older than a state. It's older than the church. It's old as humankind itself.
Exactly. All right. So now we're going to get on to the third, culture and life. How Little Giants made me feel seen as a tomboy in the 90s.
Yeah, that was fun. You know, Devin Sawa retweeted my article, and that was like, that's all I needed. I guess what to say about that, right? Pop culture is a big thing for me. I don't know if there's any way I relate to people more than talking about nostalgia or, hey, do you remember that one thing from when we were kids? That helped me realize this about myself. That gave me this insight to the outside world, or even current pop culture. You know, I consume everything from Game of Thrones to Real Housewives. I have no guilty pleasures. Whatever I enjoy, I enjoy. And I think you can learn from pop culture and media. It reflects everything in real life, right? So I wanted to write about this because I'm trying to think if there was a catalyst moment. I had recently rewatched it with my kids. We'd been doing we watched The Sandlot, we watched Little Giants, we started watching the Mary Kay and Ashley movies from when I was a kid. And a lot of the things, you know, they don't hold up as time moves on.
Some don't.
Some don't. A lot of that Little Giants did, though. And we'd come so far in a culture, a lot of the things seem really kind of silly to my kids. You know, in The Sandlot, they say, you play like a girl, and it's an insult. In the 90s, that was funny. To my kids, they were like, what does that mean? You know, they didn't understand it. But there's still a lot of those things happening that happens to Becky and Little Giants, which is the assumption that girls shouldn't be playing with the boys, the assumptions that girls should only show up one way in the world. It looks different now, of course, in 2023. But for me as a little kid, always having a backwards baseball hat, always playing rugby with the boys. Luckily, I had parents who radically accepted me. They may not have known what to do with me too much, but we went to church and they never forced a dress on me. You know, they kind of just learned from early to let me be. And I think that having representations of yourself, even if it's something as silly as a different way to be a girl, was really important for developing my own identity. And that's all we need to give. It's important for my own parenting philosophy, is giving children the space to just develop into who they're going to be. And it was funny, I got a lot of hate mail from that article, with, you know, anti-trans people making comments or sending me email saying, like, good thing your parents didn't force you to have surgery and change your gender, you know. And I mostly didn't respond because they're just always looking for something to royal.
Yeah.
But I'm like, that's the point, right? Is that, like, I knew I was a girl. It was a different way of being a girl in our society. And it's the same philosophy that undergirds people who are transphobic as it does people who are sexist and misogynistic, is you want women and girls to show up a very specific way in society. And if they are too nuanced, if they don't fit what you think they should, it's confusing and you don't know what to do with it.
Yes. It's confusing. It leads to anxiety. It leads to mental health issues. It leads to, full circle, everything that we've talked about.
Yeah.
You've written a number of other articles on the Real Housewives and diet, but I'd rather not really go into that because we touched on the really important parts of eating disorders and how, you know, looking at your body and accepting and not making comments about other people, because our perceptions are so usually off. when commenting about people we don't know, and all we do is look at them, we don't know what's going on. So I think doing this, unless there's another article or essay that you'd like to talk about, I like the pop culture. I like that it ties it all together. Little girls and women, you know, being able to express themselves without being shut out, without being squashed down. I love it. Molly, if you had one piece of advice to put out there, what would it be?
Oh, wow. That's a really big question, huh? I feel like my brain is a constantly scrambled mess of competing thoughts.
Okay.
But I guess the message is reject imposter syndrome. When I decided to start writing again, I thought, oh my God, is my brain mush now? I've just been the primary caregiver for small children for so many years. I don't know if I can do this. But I said, well, I'm going to give it a shot anyway. And I went on to Twitter and I found a bunch of editors and I thought of ideas about what might be a good story to tell. And I just wrote something and I put it out there and I called myself a writer. And that's all you have to do. You just have to do the thing. You have to do the thing. You have to believe that you can do it and reject this idea of imposter syndrome that everyone else has it figured out and you don't. Because the more that I talk to experts and people who I admire and people who I look up to and who I emulate, I realize they don't have it figured out either. They don't know what's going on. And that's true for parenthood. It's true for relationships. And it's true for any professional or personal goals you have, is just to not be so caught up in what you should be doing and if you're doing it right or doing a good job or if you're talented, and just do the thing and throw it out there and see if it sticks.
Because if you don't, you're going to be missing out on a lot.
Yeah, and you might surprise yourself. So,
well, I understand that it says if you're usually late because you've stopped to pet a dog.
Always.
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 Molly, where can people get in touch with you, find out more about you?
So you can read my work, which spans creative nonfiction and poetry, essays, journalism, at mollywadzikkraus.com on my website. And I have a couple of new pieces coming out soon at Scary Mommy.
Molly, I want to thank you for taking the time. This has been fantastic. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Sylvia.
Thank you for joining me today. If you liked what you heard, please share it with another person you think would be interested. And if you haven't already, please subscribe.
This has been a Life of Prey production.